This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the winner of this year's prestigious Nansen Refugee Award sees hope in bringing education to the children of Boko Haram, the militant group in northeastern Nigeria that opposes Western education.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, an attack on a joint U.S.-Niger patrol in southwestern Niger kills three U.S. soldiers. And the South African deputy president is a slight favorite to replace Jacob Zuma at the party's conference in December.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The teacher strike in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions is coming on 11 months with no end in sight, though the government tells VOA that talks are ongoing. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé as we mark World Teachers Day.
Thousands of teachers celebrated World Teachers Day Thursday in Cameroon's capital. 26-year-old Ernestine Tabe left her school in the English-speaking town of Kumba last month to look for a job in Yaoundé. She had been without salary for 5 months due to the ongoing strike.
So I decided to come here in order to get myself involved in teaching so that the zeal in me won't die down, because as a teacher, you're always eager to teach other two to know.
Most of the schools were sealed in Cameroon's two Anglophone regions, the Northwest and Southwest, last November, when lawyers and teachers went on strike, demanding reforms to address what they describe as the overbearing use of French in the bilingual country.
You take a Francophone teacher and send to the Anglophone side of the country, and an Anglophone teacher to the Francophone part of the country, going to be teaching French instead of the subject that he was trained for. What do you think? That person cannot perform. That is bad fed.
Gideon Tanda is a leader of one of the teachers' trade unions that called the strike. The
government is not listening, and it's so deplorable now that we've had a lot of killings. People are on the run. Others are nowhere to be found, just missing. I feel terribly bad as a teacher that at this point in time, people have to miss classes for a whole year, and they are about to miss another year.
Anglophone separatist groups joined the movement, demanding the English-speaking regions form a new state they call Ambazonia. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets in the regions earlier this week to support the independence calls. Security forces squashed the demonstrators, killing at least 17 people, according to Amnesty International. VOA spoke to Teachers Association of Cameroon leader Valentine Tame by phone from the northwestern town of Bamenda.
We are asking the teachers to be redeployed into classrooms where their operational language permits them to operate. We are asking for exams of Francophone orientation be taken out of the English-speaking subsystem of education. We ask for the creation of a polytechnic to take care of Anglophone children.
Since the strike began, the government says it has recruited 1,000 English-speaking teachers, paid subsidies to private schools, and some jailed leaders of teachers' unions have been freed. The governor of the Southwest region, Bernard Okalia-Bilai, is urging teachers to return to their classrooms.
Les recommandations du gouvernement semblent avoir été comprises.
He says the state is here to guarantee their security. He says officials will continue to talk to address the teachers' grievances throughout the year. Schools in the two Anglophone regions that have defied the call to strike have been targeted by arson attacks. Militant separatist groups are believed to be responsible, and some parents say it is not safe to send their children back to school. The government estimates just 20% of students expected in the English-speaking regions have shown up for class since the school year began in September. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The winner of this year's prestigious Nansen Refugee Award sees hope in bringing education to the children of Boko Haram, the militant group in northeastern Nigeria that opposes Western education. Lisa Schlein in Geneva reports on Nigerian educator Zana Mustafa's mission to provide a better future through education for the children displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency.
Zana Mustafa sees his role as that of an umpire, arbitrating between competing dangerous forces. As a lawyer, he is well suited for this role and has successfully mediated between the Nigerian government and Boko Haram for the release of 103 girls held hostage, including 82 of the so-called Chibok girls. As an educator who has admitted the children of Boko Haram widows into his school, he has gained the trust of this militant group. The irony of teaching the children of Boko Haram insurgents who proclaim Western education is forbidden is not lost on him. Despite the group's brutality, he assures VOA Boko Haram is concerned about the welfare of its children. So you took the children of Boko Haram?
Yes.
Into your school?
Into my school.
So this was done with their complicity?
Not even with their complicity. That was a period when nobody can even go to their own place. So I now accommodated them and called the widows of those Boko Haram and said, well, let us come and find a way, something that will say, this is what we can do.
Mustafa says he has accommodated Boko Haram's religious precepts by agreeing to girls wearing the hijab and knee-length dresses and by asking them to spell out what they wanted for their children.
You want to have pictures for these children. How do we find one? They said, we should teach them Quran. I said, yes, we accepted Quran would be one. And then English, maths. I didn't introduce anything to them. I made them to say it, that they want it.
Mustafa opened a school in Maiduguri, Nigeria, for displaced and orphaned children in 2007, 2 years before the insurgency began. These children now have completed secondary school and are preparing to go to university. Zana Mustafa sees his classrooms as a sign of the reconciliation he hopes to achieve in this war-torn region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. military reports three U.S. service members were killed and two others injured when a joint U.S.-Niger patrol was attacked yesterday in southwestern Niger. U.S. Africa Command says one soldier from a partner nation also died, and a U.S. official confirmed that the soldier was Nigerian. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, which AFRICOM said took place near the Niger-Mali border, about 200 kilometers north of Niger's capital, Niamey. The United States has maintained a small force in Niger since 2013, helping the government battle two Islamist militant groups, Nigeria-based Boko Haram and Algeria-based Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb.
Libya's rival government authorities meet again this week to move forward on the United Nations' new roadmap for peace. While regional experts say reaching a lasting peace will not be easy in a country that has had 9 prime ministers since 2011, success is possible under certain conditions. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi has more.
United Nations envoy Ghassan Salameh said that after a week of joint work, negotiators agreed on a number of important issues that need to be amended in the Libyan political agreement of 2015. Salama led new talks last week in Tunisia between the rival Libyan administrations just a few days after the United Nations presented its updated plan to end the chaos in the country. Salama says the negotiating teams will meet again in the coming days. Representatives from the Tripoli-based administration and rival parliament in the east have said the sides made important compromises, particularly in reforming the executive power. While achieving lasting progress may be difficult, Jason Pack, the executive director of the U.S.-Libya Business Association, is optimistic.
It's clear that Salama has momentum, and he's trying to push both the international actors and various Libyan groups to get on the same page.
The UN mediated a peace deal in 2015 to unite the country and lead to new elections. However, the government that the UN backs in Tripoli, led by Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj, has struggled to impose its authority. Khalifa Haftar, head of the Libyan National Army, supports the rival administration in the east. He has been expanding his influence with backing from Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Russia. Some regional experts say Salama's renewed effort could succeed under certain conditions. Renan Smith is managing editor of the consulting firm Libya Analysis in London.
All the key Libyan power brokers, whether they be militias or politicians or other sort of civil society actors, they all need to be on board in this process. The UN really needs to regain some of the trust and credibility, which it's lost really in recent years. And finally, the kind of conditions on the ground will impact how well this plan can work.
Smith expects that General Haftar and his allies at the House of Representatives will be willing to join negotiations. Jason Pack says General Haftar has a role to play, but if the UN plan is to succeed, it has to involve all other Libyan stakeholders. The United States has welcomed the United Nations action plan. Smith says that's significant, especially if Washington persuades allies such as Egypt and the United Arab Emirates to put their weight behind the plan.
I think the U.S., if it does continue to engage and does strongly continue to back Salama's plan, could have a positive impact on the sort of Libyan political reconciliation process going forward.
PAC suggests the U.S. could play a pivotal role in moving the UN plan forward.
Promoting the economic stability of Libya, helping our firms and other Western firms operate in the country to address key needs like the electricity sector, where there are so many power outages in Libya, or the healthcare sector, where Libyans struggle to get the right care.
Analysts such as Pack and Smith say that breaking Libya's political deadlock requires solid unity among the international and regional players on the UN new plan. Mohammed Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib. 18 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. A Nigerian educator hopes to provide a better future through education for the children displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency. An attack on a joint U.S.-Niger patrol in southwest Niger kills three U.S. soldiers. And a teacher strike in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions is now in its 11th month with no end in sight. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Surveys say South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa is a slight favorite to become leader of the ruling African National Congress at the party's conference in December. The ANC has won every national election since white-only rule ended in South Africa in 1994. So its next leader will be in a good position to replace current party chief Jacob Zuma as president when his second and final term ends in 2019. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
President Jacob Zuma backs his ex-wife, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, to become the ANC's next leader. Sarah Gon is a policy fellow at the South African Institute for Race Relations. She says although the couple have been divorced 20 years, Dlamini Zuma's close links to the president hurt her campaign.
Although she made an appeal this weekend to say that she is her own person and should be president in her own right, I still think Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma suffers too much from being her ex-husband's candidate.
A key problem for Dlamini Zuma, a former cabinet minister and African Union Commission chairperson, is the series of corruption scandals during Jacob Zuma's years in office. Gon says Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa has credibility as an anti-apartheid activist, as the lawyer who led the drafting of South Africa's first post-apartheid constitution, and as a businessman. But, says Professor Stephen Friedman, the director of the Center for the Study of Democracy, Ramaphosa has a big stumbling block.
I think that he does have a Marikana problem.
In 2012, as one of the Marikana mine's bosses, Ramaphosa asked the police to take action against striking workers. Soon afterward, the police opened fire, killing 34 strikers. Friedman says there are people who would otherwise support him who are uncomfortable about Marikana.
But I'm not clear to what extent that will make a difference, because fundamentally this is about a battle between two factions.
Friedman says for the faction endorsing Ramaphosa, opposition to the Zumas outweighs anything their candidate may be guilty of regarding Marikana and in his private life. Ramaphosa's business dealings have made him one of the richest people in South Africa. His opponents attribute his net worth of $450 million largely to him being a major beneficiary of the ANC's policy of black economic empowerment. The deputy president has championed the poor, but has been criticized for his luxurious lifestyle, including expensive cars and vintage wine. Gon says people are so unhappy with Jacob Zuma that they're ignoring Ramaphosa's flaws, including allegations he's had many affairs with younger women.
Even the conservatives, South Africans, I don't think it would be held that much against Ramaphosa.
Ramaphosa says he wants to create an ANC free of corruption, yet, say his critics, he's been a loyal servant to Zuma for 5 years without saying anything against graft. But Friedman says Ramaphosa's usual style is one of quiet opposition to things he disagrees with.
Really, what we're seeing within the ANC is trench warfare between the faction which supports the president, the faction which opposes the president. So when one says he's a loyal servant, I think that the more accurate description would be to say, well, there's a factional battle in which you win some and you lose some.
Gon's convinced that whoever wins leadership of the ANC in December will inherit an organization that's greatly diminished, mainly because of President Zuma.
There's very likely to be a split if either side won. I think the call for unity is disingenuous because I don't think it's real.
In the campaigning, Ramaphosa continues to focus on an anti-corruption platform, while Dlamini Zuma says she'll give more black citizens access to South Africa's wealth, which she says is still mostly controlled by white capitalists. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The illegal sale of African ivory in Southeast Asia is thriving, even as China, the world's major market for ivory, promises to shut down all domestic sales of ivory this year. According to a new study by the conservation group Save the Elephants, the Southeast Asian nation of Laos is now the fastest growing ivory market in the world. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
According to the study, the retail ivory market in Laos has increased more rapidly than in any other countries surveyed in the last few years. Researchers from the Nairobi-based conservation group said at least 100,000 elephants in Africa were killed for their ivory in just 3 years. Ian Douglas Hamilton is the founder of Save the Elephants.
To give you an idea of the scale, it seems in Kenya at least to have peaked in the years 2009 to 2014. Things are a bit better now, but at its peak, the ivory trade in Africa from 2010 to 2012 was killing about 33,000 elephants a year.
He praised China, the world's largest market for ivory, for its plans to curb the illegal killing of African elephants.
One of the most remarkable events that's happened in recent years is that the major market, which is China, has had a big change in government policy. And the Chinese, having originally promoted the idea of the ivory trade, in the last 3 years, 4 years, have adopted the policy of banning all ivory trade domestically by the end of this year. We're nearly there.
But the new report shows that the number of Chinese-owned retail outlets selling ivory in Laos has increased considerably since 2013. Lucy Figney is the lead author of the report.
I think the main points which you must come away with are that it's African elephant ivory now that is in the shops in Laos. It used to be Asian ivory, and nobody thought too much about it because it was known in small quantities. I went there in 2013 and found the beginning of ivory being from African elephants, as they told me. There was a major market in Vientiane called Sanjiang Market, which had one shop at that time, and now in the Sanjiang Market and around that area, there were 20 shops selling ivory items, all Chinese shops. So it's the Chinese shops and it's the Chinese vendors. It's not Lao people selling the ivory.
This pattern was found in their earlier studies in Hong Kong in 2015 and in Vietnam a year later. They showed that over 75% of the buyers were mainland Chinese visitors smuggling ivory back home. China remains the main end user of raw and worked ivory, as recorded in monographs produced in 2014 and earlier this year. A researcher with Save the Elephants, Esmond Martin, took part in the recent investigation.
If you want to know for overall numbers in Africa, estimated there are 415,000 elephants in Africa now, and that's down by over 100,000 over the last 6 or 7 years. The interesting thing, of course, that price has also gone down, but poaching hasn't gone down significantly. Laos and Vietnam. Laos is a small country with only about 7.2 million people, but in the last few years, it's expanded tremendously on selling ivory. And the reason for that is there's almost no law enforcement.
Save the Elephants has previously expressed concerns about fringe markets springing up to supply illegal ivory items, mainly to the Chinese. The group has called for a coordinated approach among governments to halt the illegal supply chain, as Douglas Hamilton explains.
When poaching really gets going, you know about it because you see carcasses. And the people who are first aware of it, the wardens and those conservationists who keep their finger on the pulse. Across Africa, it's very, very varied. Tanzania is a mixed bag. Northern Tanzania, there's considerable improvement in Tarangire, Serengeti. Populations of elephants are probably expanding. The Salu has been an appalling loss.
He says elephant populations in the southern Tanzania's game reserve in 1970s was about 100,000, and that the number has plummeted over the years due to lack of law enforcement. Other countries facing serious threats to elephant populations include Mozambique, Gabon, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, especially along the Zambezi Valley. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yais Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.